This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte.
The City of Whiting will officially open the Mascot Hall of Fame to the general public today on this day after Christmas. And it's a program we'll hear more from Whiting Mayor Joe Stahura about and how it fits in well with the overall plan for the City of Whiting for the years ahead. But let's focus now first on what the Mascot Hall of Fame is all about. And for that, we're turning to the fellow who's the new general manager for the Mascot Hall of Fame, Orestes Hernandez. And thank you for being with us, and welcome to Northwest Indiana.
Thank you so much. It's quite the difference in weather than I'm used to, but it's been a fun ride so far.
We should mention here at the outset that Orestes came up here from Florida and been working down there most recently, and his family and heritage is down in the deep south. So
that's right.
So it's quite a change climatically and otherwise too. But that's one of the nice things about Northwest Indiana is that we have such a great heritage of all types of people, and it's nice to get this blend in. And what better city to show that off in is the city of Whiting, with the heritage of the people who've grown up here and live here, and in turn become business partners in the community as well too. Tell us, if you will, a little bit first about the Mascot Hall of Fame and the fact that it's more than just calling it a Hall of Fame, although that's key, it's in the name, but there's much more to that than this facility that we're sitting in now.
Well, so the Mascot Hall of Fame has been built as a children's interactive museum. And, you know, when a lot of people think of museums, sometimes they might think of old dusty objects and artifacts that you can look at and read a plaque and read the history of it. This is a little bit different, a little different take on a museum. The children's interactive piece of it is really important to us. You know, we want to make sure that we focus on the education of the surrounding community and for all of our national and international visitors. And to do that, we wanted to make sure we had the educational components that were STEAM-based, and that's science, technology, engineering, the arts, and mathematics. Mm-hmm. And so those elements are carefully intertwined in all the exhibits here on site. We also have, you know, a more traditional Hall of Fame, you know, room, you know, with artifacts and mascot of the month, outfit, costume on display, and some videos of really what the mascots do that isn't always on the news. It's the feel-good stories, the visits to the cancer ward, and the visits to the kids' hospitals, and all those great things. So we share that history of the mascots as well. But it's really encompassed within a mascot-themed children's museum.
Do you think that youngsters, of course, are familiar with mascots if they're with their parents or grandparents? They're going to a sports event, regardless of the sport, and they happen to have a mascot for a team. They see that mascot there, having fun on the sidelines, keeping the crowds entertained. They maybe see that aspect of it too, but they don't understand fully how mascots got started and how important they are in the community. You kind of just mentioned about the fact that there's a lot of community service work that mascots for professional teams in particular often, and college teams often do.
Well, you know, it's funny. The mascots are the unsung heroes of sport. You know, and sometimes we don't think about them like that, but when you're a kid, you're instantly a fan of the team your parents are fans of, right? But you may not know the players. You just seem to know the mascot. You know their name, you know their antics, and you can identify them. And you don't know whether the team wins or loses. You don't know when the players are traded or retire. The mascot's always there. So there's no change, and that's who you grow up with. And that's, you know, that's the mascot. And so we, obviously, on the Mascot Hall of Fame, we want to make sure that we highlight those really quality mascots that are doing great work in the community.
Tell us now about the Mascot Hall of Fame. It's a three-story building, which is sitting on Front Street. We're basically kind of across the street, or not far away from the baseball field here in Whiting. Tell us about the building, how it's made up, and how it fits in together to be able to offer this all-rounded educational experience for young people, or anybody, for that matter, who comes in here.
Well, so we're a 25,000-square-foot facility, three stories, and when I first visited, you walk into this imposing lobby all windows, you know, great visibility. And we've, you know, the first thing you see, if it's not the first thing you see, then maybe we need to have a chat. But the first thing you see are these gigantic, enormous mascot heads. And so when people think about a Hall of Fame like Cooperstown for baseball or Canton, Ohio for football and all the other ones, you think of bronze busts and plaques and, you know, and all these things. We've kind of taken a different take on that. And so it's a fun place. It's a furry place. And so these mascot heads are really how we memorialize, you know, the Hall of Fame mascots that have been inducted. We've got three levels. The very top level is our Furatorium, and that's where we're going to have an opportunity to have the community be a part of this this experience. That's a venue where companies can rent out for seminars and meetings and company events. Birthday parties for sure will be a big business for us, a pretty good revenue stream for us, mostly on the weekends, I would imagine. You know, corporate events and seminars. We just had our Furti fundraising gala two nights ago. And just to see the decoration and how it was laid out, you can visualize the kind of events we can host here. Gala dinners, award ceremonies, mascot boot camps, all the sorts. So it's endless what we can do. And then as you get to the second and the first floor, that's where our exhibits are. And so the first floor is a little less less structured, more free play type activities. The second floor is where more structure comes in. And you start your experience in an auditorium, and Reggie comes out and tells you where you are, why you're here, and what you're going to do. And then the doors open, and he says, go through those doors and do it. You don't want to hear from me. We want you to do it. And go learn those topics, STEAM, all STEAM-based, going with the exhibits. And you finish at our Build-A-Bear shop, and, you know, there's quite a bit to do.
When you take a look at all of the different exhibits and the different interactive events that young people that come here will have a chance to learn a little bit about here, it all comes back, though, to this this overarching theme is that you're talking about mascots, about the visual part of a sports team or any event team, I suppose, for that matter, to let them know that there's something very special about being a mascot and how they seem to fit into the community, don't they?
Well, and, you know, I think... Again, I can't say it enough. They're the unsung heroes of culture. It's a cultural phenomenon in this country. And the mascot has a very big following, the concept of mascots, very big following internationally, in Japan, Mexico, all throughout the world. And we've actually got from Manchester City, Moonchester. He's our mascot of the month for our first month of opening. And he's on display in the court. You know, those kind of things, it's really about educating why they're here, why they're important. You know, and we expect to do that pretty well. And really the goal, so the goal of this building is twofold. You know, and it's going to take time to get there, but I really think we'll get there pretty quickly. On the museum side, the goal is to get to a point where we can be considered in the top 10 children's museum in the country. And I think we have an opportunity to do that. There's a lot of competition, a lot of great children's museums around the country. I think we can get there. And then on the Hall of Fame side, you know, really, I want to be considered in the same, at the same level, you know, in the same sentence as Cooperstown, as Canton, Ohio. I want to be considered at the same level as those Hall of Fames.
Whiting Mayor Joe Sahura is obviously very proud about the Mascot Hall of Fame opening up here in his city, and he's with us to talk about it. And Mr. Mayor, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
I'm glad to be here.
Well, we know that from the Hall of Fame standpoint, Mr. Hernandez has filled us in very nicely on details about what you actually see when you come up here on the Front Street, right on the other side of where the baseball stadium is, but you get to actually see what this great facility is like. Tell us about your feelings about having got this major accomplishment taken care of as far as the overall big picture of economic development in Whiting.
Sure. It's. I mean, we're glad to be complete, and we're starting to bring people in the door now. It's been over a 5-year journey to get to this point, so we're all ecstatic that we're able to share it now with the general public. most people have to understand that this is the Mascot Hall of Fame's, the name's a little misleading. This is really an interactive children's museum.
Yeah.
And the idea is to bring families and the kids to Whiting, Indiana, so that they can then spend some time on our business district or in our business district and help support our businesses. And that's really the greater picture for economic development. We're using this building and this facility as a catalyst to help us not only sustain our business district, but also help us grow it.
That's one of the important things I think that's always been the case, even since the before the announcement that the Mascot Hall of Fame wanted to relocate a physical presence here in Indiana, that you wanted to be able to bring something in that will in turn, of course, not only mean dollars for the city to boost city government's operations, but just boost the city of Whiting in particular, because it's... What do I say? It's like a one-industry town, but it has been pretty much a one-industry town for a long time because of the refinery and related businesses, I guess.
Yeah, sure. When a refinery plays such a large presence or a large role in our community, that you know you need to start diversifying a little bit. And what we're trying to do is invoke a little bit of a tourism strategy. You know, our lakefront park has been a huge addition for us, and it's now bringing hundreds of thousands of people into the community. And now this is our second phase of that project, to now hopefully bring additional people from not only the Chicagoland area but across the Midwest. We've got an amazing amount of support from media calls and stuff throughout the country. Hopefully the word gets out that, you know, we have something here that's not only unique, but can entertain kids and also teach them as we go.
Well, this always fits in well, too, with not only with baseball, with the Oilman here in Whiting, and also now with the Mascot Hall of Fame and the Children's Museum that it really is. But it all goes very well with Pierogi Fest and all the other great events that are always staged here in Whiting.
That's right. You know, the marriage between Pierogi Fest and the Mascot Hall of Fame is actually pretty neat and pretty close. So, you know, characters of the Pierogi Fest, we have characters in the Mascot Hall of Fame. So, I think you start seeing a presence now across all of our events, a little bit of a mascot theme. You'll probably see mascots appearing at Oil City Stadium now in the ball field, too, from time to time. So that's our goal now, to kind of be a two-horse town now, not only Pierogi Fest, but also the Mascot Hall.
Looking at some of the other projects for economic development that you've helped work on over the years here for the city of Whiting, what else is in the works that you're planning on as we go into 2019?
Okay, one of our biggest challenges was that once we developed our lakefront and we built, put all the infrastructure in out there on the shoreline, that we needed to now start focusing on programming. So a lot of people have now heard that we have the Woe Zone, which is a floating water park out there now, and it's had a tremendous success. You know, almost 30,000 people a year now are coming to use that facility in a very short period of time, probably about 8 or 9 weeks in the summer. So now we're looking to add a couple more attractions at the lakefront park. We're planning a large, what we're calling a destination playground now, to where it'll be larger than a neighborhood playground, enough to bring several hundred kids participate and play, and that hopefully brings another wave of people through the community as we progress.
Now, as far as new businesses and the like are concerned, and even in some new industry into the city of Whiting, what's in the works, and what do you hope to accomplish here?
Yeah, with the lakefront development and now the Mascot Hall of Fame, we do have multiple conversations going on with developers right now. It looks like our focus is going to be on adding additional residential units, which will probably end up going up, meaning apartments, multi-floors. There'll be a lot of commercial space added in those projects, too. We are certainly trying to land a hotel here to help support our tourism-related strategy. And all those discussions are in the works, and I think you'll start seeing some things happen over the next year or so.
I was wondering if a hotel was not in the works sometime or another, because you have so many people that will come by to take advantage of the opportunities of not only of the tourism benefits here in Whiting, but here in the region, Lake County in particular. Want to keep them around to have them spend some time and some money here in Whiting, don't you?
Sure, it's real easy to get somebody here for a day, but when you can keep them here for more than one day, say a day or two over the weekend, that certainly changes the perspective on how much, how long they stay, of course, and how much money they spend. So we're certainly looking forward to that, and we're getting really close to coming up with maybe a project that we can announce.
Well, that's great. We're looking forward to that in 2019. We appreciate you spending time with us to talk about the non. Tourism side, that is to say, not the mascot related side of the city of Whiting. Mayor Stuhura, thank you for joining us today.
The induction ceremony for the next mascots, by the way, will be held on the weekend of August 14th, 15th, and 16th at the Mascot Hall of Fame in Whiting. Parades and a lot of other events are planned for that weekend. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. It's time once again for another edition of Green Fleet Radio, and here's your host, Carl Lissick.
Well, thank you for that introduction, and today our guest is Mr. David Schatz. He's the Director for Policy for ChargePoint. David, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Carl. Good to be here.
So, Dave, tell us, what is ChargePoint and what do you do?
ChargePoint's the largest network of electric vehicle charging stations in the nation. We have over 57,000 charging spots in our network nationwide. And I'm Director for Public Policy, so I work with legislators and regulators across the country to see how we can scale EVs in every single market.
We hear a lot about electric vehicles, but are people really buying them?
And you're right. We do get a lot of attention. The electric vehicle market mm-hmm. does get a lot of attention, but I think it's warranted. The numbers show that there's significant and sustained growth in this sector. And nationally, sales are double what they were just 3 years ago. There have been nearly 1 million EVs sold to date nationwide, and that's an incredible number when you consider that 10 years ago, there were relatively few models that mm-hmm. were even available on the market.
No, so that is so correct. So why are people making the decision to go to electric, David?
For most folks, it's simple dollars and cents. EVs are cheaper to fill up than gas cars. They cost less to maintain. And most importantly, new models are getting cheaper to buy. The increase in sales is due in large part to the growing number of actual models for consumers to choose from. And nearly every single automaker has plans to introduce new electric models or to electrify their current fleet. So whether it's a sports car, a sedan, or a minivan, dealer lots will be able to offer and meet the needs of a lot of a variety of samples.
So how many charging stations are there nationwide, and how many are there in Indiana?
There are about 50,000 public charging spots available across the country. And in Indiana, there are about 300 public charging spots. There are many more private charging stations that are located either behind a fence or for private use for workplaces. And those numbers are typically not reported since they're not available to all drivers.
Sure. So I know it's the chicken and the egg question. So do we have enough charging infrastructure out there for drivers to make the switch to electric, David?
The short answer is no. Mm-hmm. We don't have enough charging to meet the needs of today's drivers, let alone prepare for the growth that we're going to see in years to come. We often hear about that chicken and egg problem. What will come first, the cars or the charging, and what will drive the market forward? I think it's not really chicken and egg. We need to look at the whole meal. We have to be able to do both at the same time.
So you're listening to Green Fleet Radio. Today's edition is with Mr. David Schatz. He's the Director for Policy for ChargePoint. So, David, I know that there are some myths associated with charging impact on the grid. So this is a question I think you probably hear daily. So can you address some of those issues?
Yeah. I've talked to a number of utilities, and many tell me that the impacts will be minimal. And, in fact, charging is actually a really important opportunity for utilities. Charging might allow us to use more of the grid's capacity, something that all of us pay for, especially at times that are most beneficial to the grid. Think about charging that takes place at home, mm-hmm. typically overnight, at a time when most folks aren't using that much power. That charging can help us to utilize the grid at strategic times. And since charging stations can be made to collect data on every single charging session, that's what ChargePoint does. It can be smart charging can help to inform grid managers of charging activities, where they are taking place, for how long, how much power is needed. So smart charging can really be a benefit to grids.
I see. So is there anything that states can do to encourage more build-out of electric vehicle infrastructure?
Absolutely. First, we have to make sure that our regulations recognize EV charging and enable all possible business models for operating charging stations in Indiana. Next, the government can help bring together stakeholders in this space to talk about, just like we're doing today, how best to achieve the build-out we really need. And finally, we need to take full advantage of the funding coming down the pike. Mm-hmm. Funds stemming from the Volkswagen Dieselgate settlement can be used for EV charging infrastructure, and the state is now deciding how to best use those funds. We think that a rebate or a grant program that's open and competitive would result in hundreds of charging stations built throughout Indiana.
So as we come to the end of our program, what is one myth that you would like to answer for our listeners about electric charging stations?
The myth that they're for only the richest folks out there. I think that's totally a myth. The price of electric vehicles is coming down. More models are coming to market. And I think within the next couple of years, every single person in the market will be able to purchase an EV. And I know that some models available on today's market are actually cheaper than the average cost of an internal combustion vehicle. So it is totally a myth that this is all for the wealthiest among us. This is for everyday folks, and I'm looking forward to seeing the growth in Indiana.
So how can our listeners learn more about ChargePoint?
You can visit our website at www.chargepoint.com.
Well, David, thank you. And that will do it for today's edition of Green Fleet Radio. Thank you again to David Schatz. He's the Director for Policy for ChargePoint. I'm your host, Carl Lissick. Thanks for joining us. And remember, it's never too late to begin your environmental legacy.
Green Fleet Radio is made possible by South Shore Clean Cities. Carl, by the way, and his podcast is also on. We'll tell you about that in a moment, but let you know first, of course, that you can hear Regionally Speaking's version of Green Fleet Radio at this time on Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and the podcast for Green Fleet Radio are also on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, and on NPR One. Just search for WLPR. Governor Eric Holcomb spent a lot of 2018 focused on issues at the Department of Child Services, and that includes the results of an independent investigation into the embattled agency. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith had a chance to talk with Governor Holcomb about that work and what lies ahead in 2019.
I want to start with something that's consumed a lot of attention really this whole year, which is the Department of Child Services. We got the report from the independent auditor about halfway through the year. Your administration just sort of released the sort of progress report to us when we talked about your agenda a couple weeks ago. A lot of it seemed to be, we're still studying, we're still developing. Are you comfortable with where you are in the process?
Well, I'm never going to be comfortable as long as there is an at-risk population out there. And am I pleased that I think we're turning the ship around and heading in the right direction on multiple fronts? Yes, I'm pleased that we're heading in the right direction. I'm pleased that we have this action step, but as you saw, some of these are in progress. Some of them won't be in progress until the legislature gives us the tools necessary to advance. But I think there is more than a recognition that we had to do some things differently, and we're doing that. And so, yes, it will require a true up in the budget of about, you saw what we're proposing, and you'll see a lot more in detail on January 10th when we submit our budget. But truing it up to that 286 level is another step in the right direction.
There seemed to be the sense, again, when DCS submitted its budget request to kind of bring it up to where it's already spending, that everybody said, yeah, okay, let's do that. But then we got a fairly eye-opening revenue forecast. Do you feel like that's a number that might change?
We're confident that that's what's needed. And I think it's evidenced by past spending and where it's actually going. So again, I want to hear what their ideas are, and if they got a better idea than we have right now to draw that down, I'm all ears. But what I know is that 286 reflects what our priorities are right now, and we're prepared to not just defend them, but to hopefully be persuasive about them.
And then, very quickly to wrap up, you're going into 2019 in a hate crimes debate now, in which the people on the other side of this who say, no, we don't want this law, are some of the people, the same people, or at least led by some of the same people that you faced off with in a marriage plank debate last year or earlier this year. Why are you confident that you'll win this fight when you didn't win that one?
I need to do a better job. I'll take some responsibility for this. In the past, I haven't weighed in heavily, monitored it, were part of discussions. When I thought it was going to be counterproductive, politely intervened. I'm all in on this. And we live in a different time than we did in even 2005 when I first started hanging around this place. When the governor at the time and when the Indiana Economic Development Corporation were pitching the state of Indiana successfully, I might add, much of the discussion was, you know, workforce for sure, tax and regulatory environment. It is a different world today. And if we want to continue to attract talent, quality of place and space and life, ultimately, factor, it's one of those boxes. And matter of fact, it might be as important as your tax and regulatory environment to many. What I really worry about is all the conversations I never get to, because they just fly over our state because they know we're on the 1 of 5 list, not the 1 of 45 list. And so it also makes business sense.
Thanks so much for sitting down with me.
Thanks, Brandon, very much.
What do kids do to keep occupied and enjoy the holidays to the fullest? Well, let's turn to Tammy Silverman, who's president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute. Maybe some advice and certainly some ideas that the IYI has to deal with. Tammy, thanks for joining us today.
Always a pleasure, Chris. Happy to be here.
Well, let's take up the question first about having youngsters ready in advance. I guess, I mean, they know the holidays are coming, but it's a little more involved than that, isn't it?
They do. Obviously, they know, and they've seen it everywhere, and they've heard conversations. But what sometimes they often miss is they don't understand what's happening in what sequence. They don't know if today's the day that you're going to a school concert or to a church concert or when you're getting together with this side of the family or that side of the family. We often hear kids say, nobody told me. And so if we can keep our kids updated, then they know what to expect, and they know what gatherings are coming up. They know, you know, we should tell them who will likely be there, who they'll be seeing, how long these things will last. And then finally, let them know what behavior is expected from them. Obviously, there are some activities where kids kind of can be a little more rambunctious, and maybe they're loud and they play games, and maybe they even have a section of the house, the basement or a back porch or something, where they can be a little more rowdy than other events, which are maybe, you know, a service or a concert where different behavior is expected of them. You know, the more we can prep kids in advance, yeah, the easier it is all around.
Well, this is probably even more than just the usual note on a calendar or maybe on the whiteboard stuck to the refrigerator or something like that. You know, you're going into a little more details about how they're supposed to act, what they're supposed to do, and what they're supposed to be ready for, I guess.
Absolutely, and reminding them who various folks are. Sometimes those big family gatherings, they've forgotten that, you know, this aunt goes with these kids, and it's confusing for them, and it's hard for them to keep track of. So again, just having some casual conversations, it doesn't mean there has to be a giant plan laid out for them, but, you know, just making sure that they know what's coming up and what's expected.
All right. One of the other things, obviously, with the holidays come gifts, and there's a very important way to be able to teach young people the joy of giving gifts as well as receiving them.
Right. So many times, you know, we talk to kids about what do they want, you know, so that they're building their list for Santa or whatever those things are, but it's equally as important, if not more so, to talk to them about giving to others. So talking and engaging kids in selecting or making gifts for other people. And again, this is where you can ask even little kids, what do they think that special person would like? You know, maybe a grandparent or a close family friend or even one of their friends. What might be a way that you can let that person know you're thinking of them at this time of the year? And, you know, I think one of us as parents, sometimes we're so caught up in trying to do things quickly that, you know, that takes a little extra time. But the kids can sometimes come up with fantastic ideas or observations that we might have been in too big of a rush to think of.
Well, I think we forget, too, what's it like to be a kid? You know, the older you get, the more these memories seem to recede in our memories. And it's really nice to get that fresh look, I suppose.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I was thinking of one situation that we knew of where a parent did this with a child, with a grandparent. And the kid just said, well, you know, Grandpa really likes this particular, activity, and I think we should get him something so that for fishing, right? And he had some really precise, hey, I was there and I saw he was looking at this and he was talking about this, and it was so insightful and so meaningful, much more so than it might have been if that parent wouldn't have asked the child.
We're talking with Tammy Silverman, who is the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute, and get some ideas about how youngsters can enjoy the holidays. And one of the other things, besides giving gifts, is to be able to give as well. That's part of the other side of the equation, I guess. And you were talking, too, about what youngsters can do, which they may have some time at home since they're away from school, but they can make a real difference and show how important it is to give back to the community or their neighborhood or their friends.
Absolutely. And this goes beyond people they know really well, right? And really letting them think about and learn, too, that there are people in our community that this time of the year can be difficult for. And so helping them think of those individuals, and if there's some way, if it's within your family's capacity, to help them give to that, you know, those folks. It might be, you know, letting the kids be the ones that drop some change into the red buckets, or participating in a toy drive, or volunteering some time around the holidays. Even those little things can, again, kind of widen that perspective of it's all about the presents the child is getting, and really help them think bigger picture and more about contributing to their community and their state.
Now, don't you think it would be fun to go out shopping with the grandparents, and maybe grandpa happens to slip a little thing in their hand and yeah. say, go put that in that red kettle. It turns out to be a gold Krugerrand or something like that, you know.
Right.
A real nice surprise.
Again, we've heard, I've heard a lot of even adults working in youth serving professions talk about how that culture of giving back was started in their families at a really young age, right? Mm-hmm. And so, again, recently we were talking with a group that was doing a sock drive for a homeless shelter, and the kids were kind of like, what's up with all these socks, right? Why are socks important? And having that conversation that for homeless people, their feet often get wet and cold and can lead to some health issues. So having and contributing and getting a whole bunch of new clean socks was really meaningful for that group for that particular organization. And I can tell you, this group, this was a particular group of middle schoolers, had never really thought about it before. And yeah. Suddenly it took on a whole new meaning for them.
Well, next on the note here is not only doing things, keeping involved during the holiday time off, but also to try to keep those routines in place. That's tough to do, I know, but it's very important to do so.
It is tough to do. But at the same time, kids really thrive on routines. So stable bedtimes, healthy foods, plenty of exercise. And all of that can be a tall order during the holidays, and we know there's going to be a couple of days where the schedule's out the window. But it's important, as much as possible, leading up to those days and following those days, to get back to the schedules, right? So that mm-hmm. it's all right if one day there's lots of extra cookies and treats and those kinds of things, but the next day, try to get back into your patterns. Let the kids, you know, they do need time to blow off steam and to run and get some of that kinetic energy out, and that can be hard to do around the holidays. The other thing that's suggested is try not to the extent possible, again, not to schedule more than one major holiday event per day. And sometimes that's not possible, but if it's not possible, if you can, schedule a little downtime in between so that kids aren't going from one high-intensity event straight to the other.
Now, you talk about daily breaks, and maybe if you've got a really, really busy day around Christmas especially, and maybe even around New Year's Eve, how about mom and dad and grandparents? It's time for a break too, don't you think?
Right, right. It can help everyone. And, you know, I think this is where sometimes as adults we can get so caught up in trying to make the perfect meals or get the perfect gift or have the perfect, you know, event or gathering. The reality is it's really just about spending time with the people that you care deeply about. So setting aside some of that downtime to relax, play games, watch movies, do some things that can lead to some of the best memories that are out there.
Well, we've talked here a little bit about the holidays, the ones coming up here. Let's take a look, I guess, back now, actually, to how 2018 seems to have shaped up, Tammy. How has 2018 been in terms of helping Hoosier youth try to deal with their problems?
Well, I was going to say, I think we have a lot of great possibilities on the forefront, I would say, and yet it's going to be up to us in 2019 to really activate on those. I think we've seen a lot of groups coming together to say it's really important that our kids get all the conditions they need to thrive. So, for example, there's been, particularly this summer and this fall, a real attention being paid to the health of our kids. And when I talk about that, it's obesity, it's infant mortality, and then most recently, there's been a lot of attention being paid to nicotine use by kids. And we know that kids, most adult smokers start as teens. In fact, 9 out of 10 start before the age of 18. We know that it's going to be a big push in 2019 to make sure that we prevent kids from stopping nicotine use before they start. And that's also not just cigarettes, but e-cigarettes. So that's going to be a big push. We've made progress. We've laid some great groundwork in 2018. It's still going to be going on in 2019, as is school safety. We know, unfortunately, we've seen the event in Noblesville last spring. There was most recently another event just last week in Richmond. We need our kids not only to be safe, but to feel safe in their schools. And we know that, again, Indiana's done some great work on putting those plans in place. But I also know from working with some of the leaders in state agencies, that's going to be a big issue in 2019.
And I imagine, too, this we get near the end of the year, calendar-wise, we take a look at the data that's going to be coming in here after the new year begins, and we'll be putting together more information later to come out in the first of the new year, I imagine, too.
Absolutely. Our 2019 Kids Count data book is almost ready to go to the presses, and it'll be coming out in February. And there's a tremendous amount of great data in there about all kinds of child well-being. And obviously, we publish that so that youth-serving organizations and all the folks that are working to serve kids have the data they need to hopefully execute all of their goals and missions.
Well, Tammy, thank you very much, and happy holidays to you and everybody who's on the staff of the Indiana Youth Institute for the info and for the great help during 2018. And I hope that 2019 turns out to be a better year after all.
Always a pleasure. Thanks so much, Chris.
You're welcome. Tammy Silverman is the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Today we offer the first of two personal stories about drug and alcohol addiction. The series from Side Effects Public Media is called Sober, Stories of Recovery and Hope, and the stories are drawn from people who described their battles at an event recently in Indianapolis. Our first story is from Brandon Dryman, who helps others fight addiction.
Thanks, everybody, for being here. Thanks to all the other speakers for sharing. I think we've probably all learned quite a bit tonight. My name is Brandon Dryman. I'm a firefighter paramedic with the Indianapolis Fire Department. I'm also the coordinator of the IFD Peer Support Program. I've been a firefighter in Indy for 17 years, but my story starts when I was 16. I grew up in Vincennes, Indiana. Has anybody here been to Vincennes by chance? A few people? Good. So, you know, that's small town USA. And growing up there, I had basically four heroes. I had Mr. Rogers and Cowboy Bob. And Johnny Gage and Roy DeSoto. So we all know Mr. Rogers, right? Most people from Indiana know Cowboy Bob. Does anybody know Johnny and Roy? Fellow firefighter and back, what was that from? Does anybody know? Similar, it was a spinoff of that. It was from Emergency. So it was a show about firefighter paramedics. And it was because of that that I decided to do what I do now. I had a very strong impression. So when I turned 16, I joined the local volunteer fire department, and I also started driving ambulances. At that time, you just had to be 16. I don't know what the current regulations are, but again, small town. I was certified in first aid and CPR, and that kind of began my journey in public safety. I turned 18, went to EMT school, got my EMT cert, and started doing that. Paid my way through through college bills that way. And progress on to the current time, became a career firefighter, went to paramedic school, and that brings us up to the current time. But over that 28-year period, you know, I was exposed to a lot of things, particularly at such a young age, at 16, that I was not ready to deal with on any level. And first responders generally don't talk about the things we see just because they're hard to describe, but it is a difficult job. And I didn't process that very well at all. I had behavioral health issues, but because of the stigma, which has come up so many times, I was not going to reach out for help, period. And rather than seeking out that professional help, I used, you know, I was too macho. I was too tough. I don't need that stuff. I can handle this. Everybody else is handling it, right? What do they do? Well, we drink a lot. So that's what I did too. And I lived with severe alcohol use disorder for a long time, a number of years, until 2012. And it's interesting that 2012-2013 mark has kind of been popular in here tonight. But I came to work, regular day on shift. My captain stuck his head out of the office window and said, hey, you've been picked for a random drug screen. Head down and get your drug screen done. and that also included a breath test. And I remember joking as I walked out of the firehouse, all the other guys were sitting at the table. And I said, hey, I guess I won't be seeing you guys for a while, tongue in cheek, because I thought I was going to be fine. I wasn't intoxicated, but my tolerance was so high that it didn't matter. I had drunk so much the night before that when I had that breath test, I still had alcohol in my system at 9 o'clock the next day. So that's when like everything just kind of hit. And again, that ego that kept me from getting help in the first place kicked in again. You know, this, how can this be happening? I've been paramedic of the year and received awards for rescues I've been part of and finished first in my fire academy class, first in paramedic school, all those things. But we heard Dwight mention it and other speakers that these illnesses, these diseases don't care. They don't discriminate. And it doesn't matter how good you are at your job or what you've accomplished. If you have behavioral health problems and you try to ignore them or you try to self-medicate, eventually they catch you. They've got all the time. And that's what happened to me. So as a result of that, I was suspended. But I also had a great opportunity to enroll in our employee assistance program. And I took advantage of that. And I had a really, really great counselor. Has everybody seen Good Will Hunting? He was just like Sean, like the Robin Williams character, which is a perfect fit for me. That's exactly what I needed. And he you know, worked with me the lines of getting sober. My wife was also a big help. Just telling somebody that you're proud of them. Means a lot. So, excuse me. So that was 6 years ago. And I'm going to admit it. So that's how I got involved in peer support, because I knew it wasn't just me. There were a lot of people having the same problem. And with peer support, the beauty of it is it's a firefighter helping a firefighter or a cop helping a cop. And somebody can come and talk to me about their problem, their addiction, without judgment. That's not my goal. I'm in no place to judge. And they can talk to me confidentially and get the help they need. And as a result of that, I can't even count the number of people just in Indiana and Indianapolis that our team has helped. And a big part of that is because the Indianapolis Fire Department takes behavioral health seriously. Chief Malone has made it a priority to make a whole separate division in the Indianapolis Fire Department just to do this. And we travel the state to help anybody we can. It also gave me the opportunity to get involved with the International Association of Firefighters. And we go out and teach 30 firefighters at a time how to set up their own peer support programs. And that's really where the beauty of recovery comes in. Because I'm just one guy, but I can teach 30 people how to do this. And then those 30 people talk to 30 people, or 50 people, or 100 people. And it just spreads from there, that ripple effect, just from one dude getting sober. And something I never thought I would do is go around the country and giving lectures and presentations and being part of panels where I normally don't cry. but I never thought I would do that. But again, it's that ripple effect of how many people hear those lectures and go back to their departments and their administrators and make changes for the better because of that. And I know that sounds like a lot of I and me. And I just want to be really clear that it's not, nothing that I'm doing is a result of me. I was given a second chance. Everything that I've been able to accomplish and the people to help have been because of, in my life, three big things that got me there. The first was the Indianapolis Fire Department saw more in me that day than I saw in myself. And they didn't just throw me out of the way. They said, we want you to get better, and they gave me the route to do it. Second, I had access to really high quality behavioral health care. from somebody who cared, who understood me and showed me compassion. And that, unfortunately, is not a luxury that a lot of people have. And finally was my wife, and she has stuck with me in the dark times and through my recovery, and even now, not just sticking by me, but encouraging me to do the things that I can do to help other people get better. And I just think, I look at those and I think, how many jobs have been saved? How many families and marriages have been saved? How many lives have been saved because of those three people, those three groups? And to me, that is really the beauty and the power of love and recovery. So thank you for listening to my story. I appreciate it.
You can find the series at sideeffectspublicmedia.org, and we'll bring you another conversation tomorrow. Lakeshore Public Radio's furry friend Ollie joins us in the studio now to answer your pet's questions on Ask Ollie. The pet questions are voiced by woman-human Victoria Voller, and Ollie's responses are voiced by man-human Tom Maloney. Ask Ollie is supported by the Humane Society of Northwest Indiana.
Dear Ollie, when you were writing for the Post Tribune back in the day, every year you talked about the Charles Darwin Award for people who do dumb things with and around animals. Are you going to bestow this honor for 2018, since you are on the radio now? Signed, Diesel, the tiny dog from Crown Point.
Well, Victoria, we all know the Darwin Awards, right? It's given to somebody who, you know, depending on how you look at it, unfortunately passes away as a result of, really, their own stupidity.
Right, and nobody else's.
So Ollie's got this these awards. So it originated in 1985 in a Usenet news group. They recognize individuals who have supposedly contributed to human evolution by selecting themselves out of the gene pool via death or sterilization, again, by their own actions.
Wow. Yeah, I've always enjoyed reading those, too. The criterion for the award state: in the spirit of Charles Darwin, the Darwin Awards commemorate individuals who protect our gene pool by making the ultimate sacrifice of their own lives. Darwin Award winners eliminate themselves in an extraordinary, idiotic manner, thereby improving our species' chances of long-term survival.
It's a nice way of putting it. And yeah. I will say I've got my favorite Darwin Award that I remember from way back when I was a kid. It was this guy who had vision problems, and he couldn't be a pilot. And so he decided to build his own airplane. Except unlike the Wright brothers, he used his car. And I don't know how he acquired the engines, but he managed to fixate engines on the side of his vehicle, took his car, drove it off of a cliff, and into the side of a mountain on the other side of the valley. He was missing for weeks. And then somebody, I think they were hiking or as a forest ranger, whatever it is, saw the glint of the vehicle across the valley. And after they saw that, they kind of pieced everything together. And he literally flew himself off of a cliff in a super powerful car airplane into the side of a mountain.
Wow, that really is suicide by stupidity. He would be tough to beat. Now, we have some here that are nominations by Ollie that he's done because he's been reading this year. And there are some that are pretty crazy. But that one may stand out as being the dumbest one I've ever heard.
All right, let's find out from Ollie then what they are here. The Ollie Darwin Awards are a little different. We recognize humans who do stupid things that involve animals. What's interesting, if you look at this from a worldly perspective, is the nominations are endless. And I will say this before we dig in. If you have a favorite, send us an email, ollie@lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and let us know which one you think should win. Here they are. The tale that has to be beaten is from February 2017, and it won my award last year. First, let me say that my woman human and her friend Donna Penn from Ogden Dunes love elephants and respect their worlds. Neither has ever intruded in their lives or their sanctuary. However, they do enjoy wearing elephant pendant jewelry. No ivory here, and they decorate their homes with statues of elephants. So, As a dog, I have grown up with elephant images everywhere and have come to love their intelligence and grace. In Zimbabwe, Africa, three male humans, three male elephants, and a dream of a perfect wildlife selfie combined to make the perfect tragedy. In the town of Plumtree in southwestern Zimbabwe, Mr. Moses Ndulov spotted three elephants in the bush. This will not do, he thought, and he and two friends began to drive the three male elephants into a clearing. The elephants cooperated, in a manner of speaking. Then the large bull elephant and two younger males came charging out of the bush and headed right for the men. It was time to test out the old truism. I don't have to outrun that elephant, I just have to outrun you. The three men took off running, each frantic to save his own hide. Moses, lagging behind and still foolishly interested in a photo op, was trampled to death by the angry bull while his two friends escaped. The entire blunder was a pointless waste of time for man and beast. I'm sorry you're dead, Moses, but what were you thinking? As a consolation, your lamentable death serves as a warning to others. Elephants are social animals, but not with you, and always respect their privacy. So that was the winner from 2017. Now, the first nomination for 2018 is another selfie tragedy. Frankly, all selfies are tragedies. From Odisha, India, Prabhu Batara tried to take a selfie with an injured bear while stopping at a bathroom on the way home from a wedding reception. Batara's friends reportedly tried to deter him from taking the selfie, but he ignored the warnings and got up close to the animal for a picture. The bear quickly attacked, and despite attempts to intervene, Batara died on the spot. The bear was later treated for his injuries. That does it for part one of Ollie's Darwin Award nominations. Tune in next week for part two, and we will announce the winner in January. And, of course, we wish all of you a very happy and safe New Year.
And if you have a question for your friend and for Ollie, you can email it to ollie@lakeshorepublicmedia.org. Ask Ollie is supported by the Humane Society of Northwest Indiana. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back with you tomorrow.